friend and colleague Zabeth. I don't see a home at all among Lutherans. You know, since and it's getting worse because the German Lutherans have now conclusively, you know, they can always do that, proven conclusively. There's absolutely no reason why Lutherans and Reformed should stay apart. And we should reunite at least those two traditions kind of yesterday, since that has been proven theologically. I even see left at home here, because I'm against that kind of thing. You know, I think that we are much better off than if we keep those traditions which are so close together separate, so that there may be some chance for development. I'll come back to that a little later and get this kind of strange remark and proper perspective. But I'm glad to be back in St. Louis. The art still looks as beautiful as it's always done. And I hope to be here till Tuesday, and so I may come back to the seminary a little bit, and we have no problem with just wander around and hope to meet people rather than talk. I wanted to do something tonight which I was rather very, really very simple. Dr. Harwood said I'm going to talk about reconciliation, that's right, but more than that, I'm going to talk about conflict. And the thesis, I give that away right at the beginning so that those of you who want to go sleep can do that and still know what I said. The thesis is that I have understood finally that reconciliation means the organization of the conflict and not just moving over of the conflict, as that is often seems to be thought. Conflict, as we know, we have around in more than enough quantity for a long time to come. And I mentioned quickly four in order to have four fields in which we can look a little bit at the phenomenon. There is first of all the conflict between generations. When I came in here, one of the students gave me a newspaper in which apparently a national committee looked into the causes of violence, said that the real reason for violence in American society lies with the younger generation. That's probably true as far as it goes. In any case, it shows the violent nature of the conflict between generations. Something which in Europe, over the last year, has, I think, been the most important thing which came to the old continent, namely that we discovered that the conflict between the generations now has produced youth power, which actually toppled government six in Europe in 1968, which were either you can trace back to the generation conflict, or which simply were the generation conflict. Belgium, for instance, was the students which toppled the government. In Berlin, it was the students which got out the mayor, who got out the mayor, and very fast too. It was the in France, the government did not quite fall, but the number of the ministers were exchanged on nothing else but the revolt of the younger generation. Which means that after a number of centuries of military power of the younger generation, and not yet one generation of economic power of the younger generation, we now are finally faced with political power in the younger generation to the extent that they have become, in Europe at least, one of the five or six major political forces which sets the future of the country and which are at least as important, for instance, the trade unions as political power. Badly organized at the moment, rather violently in their expressions, new on the game of power, because there is no tradition of the way in which a younger generation actually gives form and expression to the power it has, but it is there to stay. That means that now, that any government in our day, in Europe at least, will have to satisfy the demands of the younger generation if it wants to sit. And that means that, for instance, on university reform and a number of other clear indications of the expression of the will of the younger generation, that comes. It also means that you get new political parties. We have high school parties now in a number of countries which are organized with public pressure groups. and which are of course chaired by the students themselves, with an extreme fluctuation of membership, of course, but exceedingly effective. And in a number of cities already, we had a nice little complex because the mayor, for instance, who's younger, the mayor, with some paternalism, some mayors show, but she was of course never. The mayor giggled nervously when the high school representative wanted to speak to him and said, you know, next year kind of thing. And the next thing he knew was that he was out. Because they threw a few stones through his offices, you know, and kept the police running for 5 days. And so he then gladly came to school to apologize to the chairman of the high school association in a little city in the north of Germany. Because he hadn't seen what kind of power was behind high school students today. That in itself is very interesting, and let's come back to that a little. So there we have conflict number one, conflict between generations, violent, politically strong, serious. None of that psychological stuff any longer. You know, we speak about a generation conflict for a long time in purely psychological terms. That now will have to be done in at least psycho-political terms. Second conflict, which we all live with, is the conflict between the organization of society that strongly called the capitalist versus socialist world. I strongly call that because those words don't apply to much anymore these days. But it is a conflict which we well know. A conflict which, again, is political and economic, like the first one, which has its hot spots like Vietnam, like Czechoslovakia, less hot than Vietnam, and considerably less hot because of the restraint of both parties in Czechoslovakia. But a conflict which will be with us for a long time because we apparently do not really want to have that one reconciled. And so we have containment policies on both sides, and with that invite because violent outbreaks of that conflict. More serious than that one, I would say, is the conflict between North and South, a conflict between developed nations in the economic sense of the word, not necessarily on all the other levels of human existence, economically developed, which hold the key to the world market, and which therefore dictate the terms under which the other countries can develop themselves. And the terms are dictated, and the terms are clearly favorable to developed nations, so that developing nations, whatever they do, cannot develop, either in the phase they would like or the phase they are able to if they their development would be facilitated, but they are kept poor. A beautiful example is the relation between the Netherlands and India, which is of course not very important because the Netherlands are so small. But over the last 3 years in development aid gave India $8 million each year. And we burned on Indian imports, on which we put tariffs, of course, to protect our own production. We earn $12 million per year. And then we don't understand why the Indians are not more grateful for the $8 million development aid. You get it crazy. You know, you don't have to think, it's not even a loan. Just give them $8 million. And then we earn $12 million. And so they are poor in the rest every year. And that, of course, accumulates. And if you do that with other countries in India, you will see that India, by the preferential tariff systems of the rich, simply doesn't have a chance. And that is true for most of the countries. Development now takes place at a level of something like 2.5% for gross national income in the developing nations in general. And in order to ever close the gap, we would need an 8% increase. And in order to stay where we are, we would need a 6% increase. In other words, every year we lose out another 3.5%, and therefore starvation grows. For a certain area of the world, unless a real miracle happens, I mean a real miracle, not one we do, but one that you couldn't even predict if you, however, the 70s are going to be starvation decades, so that lots of the world will look like the Biafra, which we'll have. Starvation is about responsible for 40 million deaths a year, and that will probably grow in the 70s to 100 to 150 a year, million people a year. There is a conflict because the South, the developing world, insists that it's our responsibility. They say it has very little to do with themselves. It is not because they don't work, it's not because they don't have the possibility to develop, it's not because their soil is that poor, although some of the soil is not very fertile. It is not because there are no chances for them, but because the chances are kept away from them, because their development is not taken into consideration by other nations, and because we keep earning money on them. And so the developing countries increasingly blame Europe and the United States for their starvation. You get even people on the presidential level, like the IARERA, for instance, who come to the Food and Agricultural Organization and speak about the developed world's mass murder in the South, meaning the developing nations. And therefore, a simmering conflict, which is of course under the strained relationship between, let's say, Cuba and the United States, underneath strained relationship North Vietnam, United States, and Europe, very much underneath the strained relationship of certain African countries with France, and so on and so forth. Also, funnily enough, under the strained relationships between developed Israel and developing Arab world. The conflict between the rich and poor, in which the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, and therefore, funnily enough, the poor get more power every year, because as you well know, unless you don't read Marx in the seminary, remember from Marx, that those people are invincible who have no hope left. In other words, hopelessness is the ultimate form of power. If there's nothing to lose, there's only something to gain. And I take it that the power of despair is growing all the time. The power of despair, which is much stronger of course, than the power of computers and tanks and divisions. We have seen that in Vietnam, where we all were on the side of the South Vietnamese government and lost the war, it seems. So, conflict number three. Conflict number four of a very different nature, the conflict in the church between the conservatives and progressives. Maybe 2 years ago I still spoke about the conflict between confession. I have given that up because I don't think that exists anymore. By that I mean that we do not have a clear-cut conflict anymore between, if you want, Lutherans and Roman Catholics or Presbyterians and Baptists. Because all traditions are now finally so diversified and so complex that you find everything in every church. Hans Kuhn is a beautiful example of a Reformed theologian in the Roman Catholic Church. There's nothing missing there, and yet he's a good a Roman Catholic in good standing. He doesn't even have a monism on his desk from the Holy Office. There are, in the Dutch Reformed Church, there are a great number of Methodists, Episcopalians, and a number of very high church Anglicans, and even a number of people who are really Roman Catholics. But we do not change confession anymore because the exchange, the conversion from one denomination to another only happens on real important reasons, like I like this neighborhood or this is the city where I live. But that does not happen anymore in terms of because I think that they believe the right things. That means, however, not the fact that that conflict between the confession is past, and I think it is past, does not mean that the conflict between in the church has died out. On the contrary, the conflict between the progressives and the conservatives is terrifying in its intensity. I spoke about I used the words progressives and conservatives. And by that I mean two trends in the church which I think are both necessary for its health. That's why I'm concerned about conflict. I'm not speaking about reactionaries when I speak about conservatives, but I speak about conservatives. There are people who are mainly interested in just the church to preserve its tradition, which is a hell of a lot. When I speak about progressives, I don't mean the wild troublemakers, which we have also in abundance, but I'm speaking about people who are mainly interested in communication of the gospel to this actual society. both deal with the same subject matter, both deal with the same problem. One, however, starts deductively from the tradition, the other one starts inductively from society. That's where you get the conflict between two methods. And that conflict goes through all churches. Beautiful example is the Church of Rome, which is in a very healthy development, I would say. But where the Pope is a conservative, he's not a reactionary, as some people say. None of them wants to go back at all. The man who is for change, like all good conservatives are for change. But it's the kind of change that should come about if he really applies deductively what Vatican II has said, and then all of it. The progressives in the Roman Catholic Church don't want that. They say the Vatican documents are the best expression of a past period. And we start right from there and go on. The conflict of the Pope is very understandable, I think, with his own progressives, because he assures the progressives whom he accuses of the same kind of treason to Vatican II he is accused of himself. So it depends on whether you come to Vatican II conservatively, that's to apply it first and then you will see what is next, and apply that. Or whether you come to it progressively and say that's at the end of the last year, that's how go on from there. Great conflict in the church. We have it in World Council of Churches. We have it everywhere. You see it clearly when the budget of any church is drawn up. There are a number of people who are interested in what we call experiments, for want of a better word, which really means that you say the most important thing you want to do is find a new form which for this society at this moment is the necessary thing to do. And you find a group of people who are the conservatives and they know in any given situation always the same thing has to be said, at least that, you know, and say as good as you can, but... And so on and so forth. Conflict is richly among us. That's my first point, that's the point for the good professor, the good Calvin. Second point. It seems to me tragic that most Christians have fallen prey to the temptation to think that conflict is a bad thing. In other words, in the church, when there's conflict, people think it's sin. You find it all over the place. You get a pastor in the church, he stirs up a little conflict, and he's fired because he's done the wrong thing. Or you get someone in the faculty who says the thing differently than he had, and you get a little conflict, and you get conservatives and progressives to come out, you know, and show clearly what they are, and you throw them out because that's bad. Or you get students who fight the faculty on all kinds of grounds, from smoking rules to predestination. So you get a conflict in which both parties express themselves and come to, you know, clarify what they really mean, and you draw out students because conflict is their thing. I would think that from the Christian tradition, especially from the Protestant tradition, that at least is a show of bad theology. The constitution of the Christian faith, Old and New Testament, is the constitution of a book which does nothing but speak about conflict. The major conflict, that's between God and man, which comes to the surface every time God takes an initiative, sends prophets to remind us what it's really like, our sons, our apostles, he calls, and the immediate reaction to that God-given injection in society is rejection. Conflict is God-given. He is the author. The incarnation is a story of conflict. And that's what teaches us forever, that the word for peace is conflict. Because when Christ is born, as you know, peace comes to earth. We have all the missions to do that, so we have dictated the terms of what peace is. And we don't quite understand how Jesus really could stir up so much conflict, and most of that we smooth over anyway, so we make it a peaceful story on our terms of peace. Well, of course, what that joke means in the Christmas night, that they call it a joke because Herod snores, the Jewish rabbis sleep, and only the shepherds were not allowed to come to the synagogue because they were outcasts. They were not there. Only the shepherds hear. What they hear is, first the conflict begins, and now you know what peace is. And of course, you know, as Dr. Howland told you a million times, with these Hebrews, it's a dynamic term. It has nothing to do with the absence of war, which is the advent of Christ. Yes. So, the Bible is conflict. God stirs up the conflicts which are substitute for human life. That does not mean that all the conflicts come from God. We shouldn't be that stupid either. We should see that at least the word conflict which belongs to the central concept of the Christian religion. Even to the extent of violence. The prophets are killed, the son is killed, the apostles are often killed. It's a violence which, however, is created by that gospel story. We cannot say that that Pilate was responsible for that violence, but Christ created violence in Pilate. A violence, however, which the Christian community apparently, or God's people on earth, apparently stimulate, ask for, but do not engage in. They undergo it. That is, a revolution is never peaceful in the sense of the human language speaks. A revolution, a conflict, is always violent. The violence of the Christian is acceptable, is respectable, he didn't hope for anything else. He does not engage in it, but he undergoes it. He attracts it like a flame attracts them all. I would think that the generation conflict, the north-south conflict, the east-west conflict, the conflict in the church between progressives and conservatives, are all in their own way direct results of injections which have clear Christian connotations. The conflict between the generations has to do with the conflict between those who have a different understanding of history. It's all around the concept of history. In which the younger generation accuses an older generation of trying to break the process of history and the ongoing forces of history, and to catch history in the status quo of the establishment. So what a younger generation does by its very nature, if it rebels at all, is revolutionized at all, this is only a small percentage. The rest is disobedient youth, quiet youth, very disobedient. The obedient youth must be a sign of ongoing history. New days are here. Dylan's famous song to the American parents, you know, it's traveled six continents because that is as good a hymn of that feeling of life as any. The times, they are a change. That's what is the constitutive theme song of generation conflict. And that in itself is a profound testimony to that the fact that we have God is not about nature in the first place, but about history in the first place, and only as such about nature. God changed, and therefore only as such God of law and order, which he is too. Only as such. The conflict between East and West has profound theological implications, because when the church refused to see the injustice of an early Catholic society, it was the Jew Marx, the Christian Engels, who left the two disobedient expressions of the people of God, community of the older son and of the younger son, and together set out on a road to organize justice. They didn't do very well on it. They did better on it than the churches. And so they brought judgment to the house of God, and as such, and as far as they did that, were instruments of God's graceful action. The conflict between the north and south, hardly have to speak about that. That is so laden with theological terms that it's not even funny. And that of course provokes, we could speak about that for hours. From the angle of the prophetic community within the people of God, it has always said that we're not allowed to do any kind of liturgical activity as long as there was a beggar in the gate. And the beggars in the gate, of course, will organize themselves. And should. Therefore the conflict which comes there has not only our blessing, but it was expected, and has our best wishes. Conflict between progressive and conservative in the church is like the first one I spoke about, namely of those who try to stand in and break history, and those who say the times are changing. All right. Point two, the sun, complex positive. A hallow thing which follows from the action of God in the tree, and its repeated initiative in the affairs of men. Therefore, when God, then there is no conflict in Israel, Israel gets Benedict. Then the work of God has power in those days. It's Benedict, then there is nobody to stir him up. Nobody, then God does not follow his conflict with men, the Psalms start to cry, "Bear, O Lord, our help." Therefore, when the status quo reigns, and that always means that injustice reigns, the psalmist starts to moan and ask God to wake up and stir up a little conflict with the rich, the mighty, those who are unjust. Third point, last one. What does Christian do with conflict? After he has discovered that it is kind of good, that it comes out of his own tradition, and after he has learned from a few of the social scientists that there is no progress in history without considerable tension and conflict, and so has woken up to the first step of his adulthood, namely that he does not deplore in conflict any longer. That's the first step to adulthood. The question then is, what do we do? And the answer, of course, is legal power. Although we know that by preaching of the gospel we stir it up, that by our prayers we invite God created, once they come, these conflicts, in the conflict, prayed for, accepted, here is the path. The example, as always, I do it all horribly quickly, but I hope you look rather intelligent. The way this Christ does that is that he comes and comes not to, that his coming itself is the stirring up of the conflict. His life represents conflict in the life of Israel. But he comes to lead us that. It is to overcome the conflict. And ever since, the church has called itself a community of reconciliation. I've seen a little bit of the church over the last 10 years by going about the globe 3 times a year, about 30 times a year. I've looked at the church, I've seen that it's called itself a community of reconciliation everywhere, and I tend to get nervous when I see what that means. Because in most cases it means that we smooth it over. We do as if we're not there. A good Christian is the one who forgets about it, shake hands anyway, keep going to church anyway, let, you know, over a conflict with the generation, let's have a little pastor who, we got a youth work so that we get those youth out of the congregation always, put them in a little corner and do little things with them and make them happy, and then the conflict is that, we don't have a generation conflict in our church. We just have the youth in the other room. And many of you earned their first dollars by doing that. How long, O Lord, how long? We do the same thing, of course, on the Christian Marxist, the East-West conflict. The thing we all hope for is that we get something of a mixed economy, and we gladly say to each other, it's going well because the Marxists are getting much more free initiative and more of a bit of free enterprise and change and come closer to us, and we, of course, we need more taxes, and we therefore go a little bit more socialist, and we'll meet each other in the middle, and it will be a great conflictless world. And we apparently enjoy that. In the North-South, we say, it's too bad if all those people are starving, so what we do is we must give them a bit more money, so we have collection, church world service, and all that, and World Council Churches, and all the church aid. We step up our contribution and give them some food and print on it a gift from the American people that may help politically too. Pretty naive that, but what we do. A gift from the American people and send it to India, and then you can eat for the next 3 days, and the conflict may just dissipate. And between the progressives and the conservatives, we say, let's have a prayer meeting and forget about it. And so we try to integrate both into both. And lo and behold, sometimes works. It seems to me that that is a pretty adolescent way of dealing with conflict. And I therefore suggest that we, when I come to my thesis, that we agree that reconciliation means the organization of the country. Example, employers and employees, where for a long time there were paternalist relationships. The employers told the employee what he wanted to do, and the employer didn't know he had power yet, and so he did it. Then the employee wakes up and organizes himself and fights conflict, strikes, burn down plans. And then finally the trade union comes into, the early trade union that is, comes into being as an organization of the company. And now the employer sits around the table with the employee and they fight it out till they have found a structure which is holding together both parties in creative tension. Or intention. I don't need the word qualifying word creative. Intention. So tension is the sign of health. It shows that there is diversity of gifts and diversity of opinion and diversity of conviction, but that all transcends that those diversities by a common purpose, which however must be a common purpose. Commonly arrived at, commonly instituted, commonly accepted. God, in his grace, after he stirs up the conflict, insists that that conflict is organized. It is not smoothed over. It requires conversion, it requires a new type of thinking and a new type of life, in which humility is married to service, to justice. There are two great words on which ethics in the Old and New Testament are written. Humility versus God and in your neighbor, and justice on earth is justice with God. And that the change takes place in the partner, so that this earth may be an inhabitable place. And the conflict between God and man may become the tension between the Almighty and everlasting and the quickly passing by PDs which we are. I take it therefore that what theological education really means is that what we stir up in the seminary are professional reconciliation. That it's people with business to organize conflict. It means in the first place that you have to make it visible. That means everybody who does youth work must refuse to take youth out of the church, but bring them straight in. Forget about the youth group with 60 members, take the 4 or 5 who are worth it, take 4 or 5 people who are the older generation and knock their heads together till a partnership exists. I hope you're not tired in the process because the mothers of the other 45 will be furious that you're hiking with them in the mountains, but give it a try. Organize the conflict between the generations means that both partners are helped to state their case as clearly as they can, and they can only do that when they meet. They probably will only do it if they stretch towards each other's eyes and fight as long until they understand each other what the conflict is, until they are ready to change the structures, in this case the congregation, but also the society, in the sense in which both can differ. That is the goal. That will always be done in small numbers, I take it, but I don't have to say that to theologians because we are not in the numbers game. At least that's what we claim. We're in the obedience game, that's a different one. So it will always happen with small numbers, and it will take much more out of us than the thing we always do. I know that some of you must get sick and tired of the senior high group, which you have to do every weekend or every Wednesday night. It's 10 times easier to do the senior high and to get a organization of the generation conflict going. Before you get 5 adults and 5 teenagers talk about sex, for instance, as true partners, may take you 1.5 years. Before you have a number of somewhat wealthier parents and somewhat critical students who really talk about politics and social organization and society, that'll take a little bit because we get awfully judgmental on each other and we have a great difficult time to even begin to understand what the other one is talking about. But it can be done. And I take it that the society would notice, that a city like this, this city would notice if there were 1,000 people in each generation that had overcome the generation conflict. It would be shown, in fact, that there would be 500 of those that would go as a change of relationships in society. But that is absolutely necessary, otherwise it was not even conflict. And it would show, because there were 500 kids who would be willing to go and explain to the rest of the generation that was up. Explain the terms of the conflict, explain to them what changes are to be expected, then in partnership these things are accepted. We need better conflict. We need professional reconcilers in the sense that we need people who say the two big organizational schemes in society are incompatible. You cannot have socialism and capitalism at the same time. If you get a mixed society, a mixed economic society, it's capitalism. That must be known. Formal capitalism, software capitalism, not any longer socialism. Looks at this moment as if all the developing nations go socialist. I do not see how they could do it differently, but I am a socialist, so you must listen to me. You must listen to me with great political filter for your ears. But of course, I am professionally deformed, politically deformed, like anybody else has. I thought that what we see since the Second World War is that all developing nations, when they get their chance to go at it themselves, create social structures. They nationalize the industry, they nationalize all the major public services, and they go at it. Well, that's basically a socialist structure. Most of them reject communism. In other words, they do not want to get at socialism through the dictature of the proletariat, which is what makes communism. They usually try to do that by a form of socialist democracy, by which all, in a party system, all have a chance to be heard in the socialization processes of the country. Then of course, if you agree, then you must say Latin America doesn't show that pattern. I agree with that. I do not think that in Latin America there is any kind of political development at the moment. But that's the kind of degree and know that. Think about Asia and Africa and the Middle East, where socialism is the normal word for the organization of society of tomorrow and today. Now, if we feel that it is worthwhile that conflict between capitalism and socialism, and there is a conflict, which is now expressed in 14 million victims a year, that needs to be professionally organized, and those tax needs to be banked together. The only way that that can happen is that we find international structures in which there are people who know both languages, and will keep organizing at that conflict till it's overcome, until we live in the tension between richer and poorer people, who however are working for one diverse structure for the world economy and world political system, which really comes down to say a better organized United Nations, a better organized technical organization like the FAO and the rest of them. That means very much, I would say, that in the Christian Church we must raise up international politicians. People who right from the beginning take international relationships from this point of view as their task and reconciliation. And it means for all of us that if we do not teach the average American congregation that we live in an international world, one of these days the average American congregation is going to wake up and suddenly realize that it's killing people. And that may well mean that the average American nation goes to the congregation goes to pot, as happened to a number of them who suddenly realized what we were in for in the last war. So I think that all these things are all expressions of life and death, and not a kind of luxury, but a kind of thing that belongs essentially to the nature of our job and community. In the conflict between the progressives and the conservatives, it means that we cannot let the other go. In other words, what I see is a pattern in the church at the moment is almost that you let the other go. You have to go progressive, there's to go conservative, and they talk about each other. That is not good enough. Because that conflict has to be organized, and that one, I have absolutely no idea where it would go. The feeling that we polarize very much between the deductive and the inductive characters, and that they do not really talk. talks within the community. We all know that both are necessary, that both are kind of good, but we do not know how to get a real conversation between the inductive and the deductive theologian of this day, whatever their view of specialization. And it probably means that students should refuse to get that polarized position thrown through. And I take it that this is a seminary where you still have conservatives and progressives on the faculty. In Europe, we sometimes only have conservatives or only progressives. It seems to me that the position and not people all the And it's a task of students to port those heads together, those blunt streams, and the complex arguments. I think faculty cannot do that. The students can inspire them. An argument. Of course, that means that the organization of the conflict is also what we do in the ecumenical movement. You know, that has nothing to do with making one big super church kind of thing. It is an attempt to bang together different professional heads and progressives and conservatives in order to get the real tension between the diverse expressions of the Christian gospel organized and productive for all. So what the ecumenical movement is looking forward to is a great conflict-rich, tense church. In the sense, the Church of Rome shows that in a beautiful fashion at the moment, in which all discussions are openly on the table, and in which a great, healthy conflict is going on, which teaches congregations better than anything else. You know, in the Netherlands, we discovered that it was a renewal of the Roman Catholic Church, that enormous fight between progressives and conservatives, it's progressive in our case one, and one hands down, which educated congregations. Conservatives always said we shouldn't fight among theologians because it confuses the congregation. But it didn't. It made them grow up. Because the fight was so bad that everybody said, what are they really talking about? And finally the whole day being polarized with them. And the fight was extended to every level, so even the Sunday school, the senior high, fought like crazy on whether he was right or he was wrong, and we grew up together. But our church was alive. Because of the church, which didn't avoid, but celebrated tension. And of course, so became renewed first of all as a liturgical tradition, because where it all happens is in the liturgy. Liturgy is the organized conflict of the congregation. It is organized, it is the conflict, because it is there that the conflict material is given to us. The word of God, stirring up men, calling them to change. What more conflict do you want? But it comes in a form in which it is in the form of a celebration. It is accepted, even though it hurts. It is translated into a hymn and prayer. And it solves a few other conflicts on the way. It solves the conflict between those dead and those alive. And we bring together a tremendous tension. So by singing the hymns of Wesley in today's congregation, or by singing Luther's hymns in today's congregation, we both create the tension between history and the now, as we all know, and we say, boy, that doesn't make much sense today, you know, that stirs it up a little. At the same time, it also organizes that conflict, because it learns us to live both in the tradition and the now. The expression of that is our frustration with the history. And we darn well better keep it. So the liturgy is the organized conflict. It is there also that the conservatives, it's there that Hans Kring and Cardinal Otaviano, for instance, can be together. Cannot do that in a theological discussion. They won't make it. That's too much. But they do that in liturgy. Hate each other's guts and live in perfect unity. That's correct. That is shown to us what the characteristics are of the community. Organized conflict. Last word, in all that, we always pay the price, which is commonly indicated by the symbolic theological term of the cross. In other words, there's no reconciliation without suffering. The suffering comes usually from the side of those who are the ones who are given the new insight, the price they pay. It is the attacker of the status quo, it's the one who represents the history, the one who comes with the voice from tomorrow, the one who is the hope bearer, who has been given the greater gift because he's in that much more fun. And so in God's infinite wisdom, he's among us. And by his suffering, he makes it possible for the other to accept. Now, the suffering is always functional. Suffering means that he gets himself out of the way. He usually dies. And then his ideas can be accepted by those who didn't want it when he was there. It's a hard price to pay for the normal way in which it goes. For those of us who are small fish, you know, in existence, in the people of God, in the history of his revelation through the history of mankind, that usually comes in small quantity. Not across the hard times, across the hard frustration. Like usually, our celebration of the resurrection is not more than just having a good time. We very seldom go to the depth of the riches and the wealth of tradition. Those who want to have the wealth and the depth of tradition must be daring enough to say to God that we are also going to pay that price. I think I'm rather happy at the end-of-being level. I hope that once I will be shown the riches of the joy of heaven, that I'm hardly willing to use the door to the pointer to get there at home. So I live with the in-between thing, kind of bourgeois faith, life faith I have, seen just enough to make it with my frustration, and just enough to hope for more. I'm rather happy that I have not been chosen to be prophet or anything which would get me straight into the press. But for the measure of the reconciliation, if you are involved, the measure of suffering can be fixed. And you can see that about, you know, your Martin Luther King and a million other examples in the sense of very true. That means also that if you go into the professional reconciliation business, as you are, you must know that you go into the professional suffering business. In the sense that the famous slap happy minister cannot exist. Christian ministry, even if it's a very normal, everyday ministry, which we hopefully all get, you will only have the amount of reconciliation according to the amount of suffering that is put into it. That means that when somebody really gets something going, be it he understands the gospel, be it he understands society, be it he even sends both, to remember that he should not be disencouraged by the fact that he has a little of rejection, that he gets in trouble. That belongs to it, and that's his sign of hope. And when it comes, smile, so that it's simply like waiting for anything you want to buy. Therefore, accept that in good grace, and don't think that something is wrong with you because you're frustrated and disencouraged. It belongs to the game. Be tired of the frustration, go in for more reconciliation. And your frustration probably will grow to the point of despair. That's good. If you want one step further, then you must go to the step of actually suffering, and then you will know what the actual joy is. Not before. So you always have to have a kind of a back door. When it gets too bad, let it go worse, that you may know better. And that's what I'm searching for, because there are situations in which you really go out for reconciliation. Then your suffering starts very soon. I think that's really all I want to say, and I hope that there's no beginning for our discussion. Thanks for your attention.
Is this organization then always a process, or it's never achieved?
Changes because you find solutions on the way. The employer-employee conflict grows, is structured for a little while, by the trade unions, for instance, and the trade unions get kind of out of hand, you know, and become institutionalists themselves. And so you get a new conflict, which is then organized, overcome. And we sit for a moment and smile at each other, and then comes a new conflict. And on we go. We would expect that because we will be promised that God will move into history at all times. So conflict is of the essence of life. And therefore reconciliation is of the essence of life. Continuous conflict on different levels, on different elements, keeps going.
Just perhaps an oversimplification, how is this similar to or different from the Hegelian thesis, antithesis, synthesis, and the continuation in this way?
I would say that refers to the same, thing. You know, I have, in a philosophical system, it always gets awfully neat.
Mm-hmm. This is why I say one.
But I think that Hegel is trying to come on board of the same reality that she has around. He didn't have much suffering in the fever state. And therefore, that's what I call the meekness. It doesn't bleed much.
Could you be more specific in stating some possible ways that the seminary could help us and train us to become professional reconcilers?
I think you better learn that on the job, so get a little conflict going in seminary. You know, it's very hard to say what the curriculum would look for a seminary which trains people for reconciling this. I think the first thing you want is to experience it in your bones. There's lots of causes that going on right today. And that may well be joined. There must be a lot of things in which really the student body feels that it would be helpful to expose the conflict if it was always there. You don't have to make it in seminary. It's very funny if there wasn't one hiding somewhere under the curtain. So get it out and then analyze the situation cleverly with the help of professors, because you know you need each other in this show. And then get it going. Of course, there are a number of things in this year which you can learn. You can learn how to expose a conflict. There are tricks for that. They are taught by social sciences. You know, you have Sal Alinsky in the New York area, is a great man on finding where the conflict is and opening it up, exposing it, revealing it, demasking it. And then you must know that the moment you do that, you know, poof, the lid comes off. And you get all kinds of explosive situations, and in the explosive situation you then must know what to do. That you can learn from social science. And I think there's so much of that stuff around because of the racial situation in this country, which is a good example of a conflict that has come to the fore. That from that you do not only learn about the race situation, you learn about conflict in general. You can do it in theology. You know, if any of you with a good course in New Testament goes preaching, and not only gives the result of his scholarly work, but puts in some of the exegetical work that's gone, I hope, into his sermon, the lid comes up in most of the congregation. Because that wasn't, not supposed to be told to. If you do that, you have a theological conflict going right there. You better not do that before you have reflected a bit on how you want to have that conflict argument. What they usually do is that we smooth it over, say, oh, no, that is not so bad, it means the same thing. But and then run with the conflict. Rather than that, we have set up the organism by which we do that, like a real adult Bible class. Now that's a good, in its best form, that is the structure by which you organize conflict. Namely, a teaching instrument in which you take what is a real exposed situation, because that, some of you may have noticed that when you started to study New or Old Testament yourself. But that's pretty conflict with the kind of faith that Mama has given to us and the Sunday school. And so, a seminary is in itself, at its best, is an organization of a conflict. Namely, you are given the tools to overcome that conflict which comes. You get more insight. The trouble is that it's, even in seminary, it's often covered up. And I think therefore the first thing is always the exposition of the conflict. Get them out. Once you get them out, then you learn the tricks on what, how to do that. And the poor chap who gets it out, of course, suffers already. like the, you know, either the minister or the layman in the congregation who comes with all the historical instructions, yes, in his sermon, he suffers. And maybe somebody in the congregation who keeps asking those questions, you know, or maybe a minister who says that, of course, the whole church does not know that, but that belongs to grown-up faith. Then he suffers a little bit, and he discovers quickly that, you know, suffering is the door into reconciliation and all that. Reconciliation would mean that the congregation, indeed, in this case, would grow together with him. Because if you don't reconcile, you have very little adult faith in the congregation, and very little real piety among the theologians. You know, it may be better in the denominational school than in most schools around, but the life of piety, and I mean that in the positive sense of the word piety, the discipline of the life of faith, among theologians, it works, and among the laity. And I think it's the price we pay for covered up conflict. And that's not good enough. You know, it's like ecumenists, I don't know whether you've seen many of those characters, but chaps like myself and people on the National Council especially, they are such professional conflict makers that they don't go to church anymore. You should check that once. You get a character from the National Council, say, you know, do you really have a life in congregation? Very often you will see that they don't, because they have not exposed their own conflict. And so you withdraw a little bit and say, I've worked the whole week in the church, I on Sunday morning can stay in bed. And of course you don't get reconciliation that way. Now I had to learn that. I, for a long time, you know, I just preached every day, morning and afternoon. And so on Sunday, if I wasn't traveling, I'd say, nice to be there, that. And then, of course, didn't understand why the ecumenical movement didn't take grassroots. Because there was a conflict, all right. There was no reconciliation, because I didn't work at every time. I didn't organize. Does that help a little? Yes?
You said I get some conflict down here. I tend to see myself kind of involved with this. My main concern would be having the reconciliation of the sins that ended up being on my side of the fence. You know, I'm going to get concerned about the issues. I'm wanting to convince the guy of my point of view. I think he has something different than reconciliation. And somehow I haven't felt to give me any help in faith and faith kind of thing. In other words, what's the difference between creating tension, get reconciliation, and creating tension is my point of view across?
There's no difference. When you do it to get your point of view across, you do it badly, that's all. And if you really organize the conflict, if you get the conflict going, you know, why do you think that finally those workers sat down with the employers? Not to organize it nicely, but to get their idea across. And what happens in any kind of organization of the conflict is, if it is organized, that both got their point across, and that therefore both find a structure which for that particular moment is sufficient. But if it is the same as long as the two partners, the conflict hasn't been reconciled at all.
Shifting just a second to another area, in what way would you carry this out or describe this, then, in talking about Jesus Christ as the reconciler?
In terms of Philippians 2, I would do that. He was the one who became man in order to organize the conflict. It's the fact that the incarnation is the creation of that tremendous conflict. What happens then is that he does not take any half answers. He goes that road through the conflict and keeps insisting that the divine and the human, or whatever you want to call the two things, are faced, meet, conflict arises, and in his suffering he reconciles too. So that is indeed the perfect example. No, that went too quickly, didn't it?
I don't exactly see where the cross is the, quote, synthesis of this particular situation. Now, of course, is this the reconciliation between God and man? Perhaps, as you say, it went too quickly. I'm trying to identify, I can, of course, see the synthesis between the laboring party is sitting down together and hammering this out, but to draw it out in its specifics and the theological aspect in terms of the reconciling work of Jesus Christ.
But is not the cross and its atonement theological expression for the organization of the conflict and its result in reconciliation? I thought that indeed that there you find the classic example of both the stirring out of the conflict, the demasking of its aspects, its organization in terms of the incarnation, and its result in terms of what we call the atonement theory, and the continuing tension afterwards. I mean, also there, the daily conversion, the ongoing life of faith keeps in the complex sphere. If you want the category of hope keeps us from forever thinking that the organization of the conflict is complete. The Roman Catholics, by insisting on a repetition of the sacrificial sacrifice, found, I think, an inadequate, profound symbol by which they indicate a continuing conflict.
In other words, you would say the reconciliation was not completed in Christ. It was organized to a point where a meeting was established, but it is a continuing, ongoing.
I would think that, again, those two have to be kept together. As in good traditional theology, in which we say yes, all for one, and yes, continuing at the same time.